I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast.
Well, it is really fun to talk with you now, like on the close eve of the release of your book, and I've been able to read about 90% of it, and I think I've seen other people out there reading and enjoying it already. So this is kind of a celebratory, fun one, and I'm hoping to release it close to the time in November, close to the time when you're gonna have it ready.
Well, that's good news.
And what was interesting, the last time we talked, you were right in the throes of editing.
Yes.
It was crazy, a crazy time, I think. And so I'm curious as to, I mean, I guess everything kind of gears up as you get ready to launch the book and stuff. So how are you doing?
Really good, actually. I should probably be a little bit suspicious of how calm I feel. That usually means I'm either forgetting something or I'm delusional. No, you know what? It feels pretty good.
Awesome.
It feels pretty good at this point. You know, everybody's, you know, my publisher's been so supportive, and I just feel really, you know, I guess at peace with the book. It was a real wrestle to get it written and get it edited. But once that was done, real sense of calm and almost release of just, okay, now it's ready to kind of go out into the world. And I almost feel a little bit, I don't know, a bit separate almost from what will happen next.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It just kind of, you know, we'll go out and do what needs to happen with it. And in the meantime, I feel like I was faithful to what I had to do, and just kind of want to shepherd that well now, I suppose.
Yeah. And I was noticing there, it's very personal. It's a very personal book, and you talk about your journey a lot in Christianity, and the ups and downs and the rummage sale that you've been involved with it, but you invite other people to do. And so I bet it's a cathartic release as well.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, you know, at the time that I was writing it, this is definitely a more vulnerable book, I think, than Jesus Feminist was. You know, definitely is delving more into probably the wrestling or the tender, you know, places where I've sort of grown and changed and evolved. Because for me, Jesus Feminist, when I wrote that book, I really was coming at that conversation from the standpoint of resolution, and from the standpoint of feeling like, you know, I lived already on the other side. And if anything, I had grown up on that side. And so for me, the fact that those things were even up for debate, you know, things like women in ministry or, you know, what marriage should look like and all that kind of stuff, for me, it was like, well, that had been resolved for so long in my life and was one of the few steady things that, you know, and throughout my life that has remained very constant. That writing it felt more like from a position of strength or even, you know, I guess some resolution. But for Out of Sorts, I mean, the whole book is about all the places where I have not had that, where I have had a lot of questions, of learning to wrestle with and own them, of embracing a different vision of spiritual formation than certainty. And so, I mean, it definitely is, you know, a lot more vulnerable, a bit more raw. It feels more unfinished, I suppose, because there isn't really a neat, tidy bow at the end of the book of saying, okay, and here's a list of the 16 things that I now used to think, and now I think, and I'm totally right, and I'll always be right. And, you know, it's more about coming into peace almost with that, that in-between space and some mystery and some, I think I know, but I'm not, you know, but I'm still open to what, you know, either, you know, I have to learn or what I don't know yet. And so, yeah, it's a very different tone, a different, you know, I guess a different way of wrestling with some of those, you know, bigger issues.
Right. And you mentioned in there that you're a recovering know-it-all, and, you know, it's funny coming from you because I don't see you that way. And I don't think that you're, at least your writing voice, comes off as very gracious and generous. So when you say recovering know-it-all, like, it's a little harsh, but maybe you could.
I appreciate that you have that opinion, but honestly, if someone went back even, you know, 4 or 5 years in my blog archives, they'd be like, "Oh dear God, this woman's such a know-it-all."
I know, and I think we've. I know what you mean.
I've just got my crazy a bit more under control now. That's all.
Well, it's funny because as soon as you learn something, you know, in I think as a younger person, maybe I felt the same exact way. Like I should actually go back and delete probably 500 posts that I've done because it was like maybe I had a point, but you know, but who cares a little bit because it's a little bit like, you know, maybe the tone isn't how I would ever write now, and it's an evolution of that.
Is, you know, and I think that even, you know, before, I think when I had a real know-it-all position, even for before I began sorting kind of through my faith and what I believed and what I was thinking, but I even ended up, you know, feeling like a bit of a know-it-all once I felt like I changed. You know, like I would look back on my old self or the things I used to believe or the people who still believe that way and be like, oh, I know so much more now, right? Mm-hmm, and then I look back even on that evolution and I'm like, Oh, child.
I know. And it's funny, you know, but looking
9 times out of 10 are not even the point.
Right. Yeah. But it's interesting what you say, though, about I see in your book that you are looking at yourself with compassion in previous, you know, previous parts of your journey, and that, you know, you're not finished, of course. And that's clear. But also, it was refreshing to see that you were looking at yourself with compassion in your former spiritual development. And, you know, there's a really circuitous route that you take in the book that in terms of I started out charismatic, evangelical, you know, went to here. And it's interesting to see the progression because it does circle back around. One of the things that really stood out to me, something you said about when you didn't have church community, because you had left the church, you had stopped going to church for about, I think you said, 6 years, and you mentioned about the loneliness of that, and I was really struck by just that you were aware enough to know that that's what you were feeling, and you know, to maybe you could speak to that period of time in your life where you, what you were going through, and how that transpired.
Well, you know, I think what I found during that time, you know, is that, you know, when your whole life is structured around church, you know, around, and your friendships are built there. I mean, you know, for instance, you know, at that time in my life when I kind of, you know, disembarked almost from church for a lot of years, was, you know, I went on Sunday mornings and Sunday nights and Wednesday nights and Friday nights, and I lived on a street with people who went to my church, and, you know, my lady who cut our hair, you know, went to church with us, and, you know, all these things. You know, so like church kind of composed my entire social structure. My entire social life. It was not only my friends, but it was the people that I worked alongside of. It was the people I saw at the grocery store. It was my life was really grounded and rooted in that sense of community. But when I stepped back from church, we actually moved all together, moved to a new city. And so starting over from scratch, and all of a sudden I realized I had no idea how to make a friend outside of church. I had no idea how do regular people do this. If you don't go to church and you aren't in a, you know, intentional, you know, sort of Christian community in some capacity, how do you meet people? How do you make friends? What does that actually look like? And so, you know, it was quite lonely. But the thing that I realized on the other side of it, at the end of kind of that 6 years, and I ended up, you know, returning to church, you know, which is kind of a bit of a longer story. And I don't think that going to church for the development of community is wrong. I think that's a really good and healthy reason why we are supposed to do that. We need community. We need one another. But I did find that community can be created in sometimes the craziest places. You know, I ended up with a lot of community in my neighborhood, and with, friendships, and I ended up with, finding people, you know, whether it was at the park or at the community center, that were, you know, really from different socioeconomic, you know, groups than me, you know, different backgrounds, you know, whereas it had felt maybe life had been a bit more homogenous before. And so, I mean, I couldn't, you know, whether it was work, you know, going to work and making friends at work and having that happen. And all of a sudden I had time for them because I wasn't busy all the time with church stuff, you know? And so it was, by the end of that 6 years, it took longer to find my people outside of church, but I did find them, and I did have that develop, and I have a lot of those friendships and relationships still in my life, even though I am, you know, now a definitely a certifiable church lady, and love my church and love, you know, doing the whole, you know, casserole and prayer teams and all the other kind of stuff that you kind of do go along with it, and it is really wonderful, but I don't think necessarily that church has the corner on what that means, you know, if that makes sense. Like, I think that you can find that in a lot of different places and a lot of different expressions.
I agree. And I had a prejudice in a similar way, even just also kind of growing up in a somewhat of a Christian bubble. I had plenty of friends that were not Christians, but it was funny that when I would see like coworkers rallying together to raise money for someone's there's an instance where they were raising money to cover funeral expenses for a person who lost their son suddenly. And I thought, non-Christians do that? It's just a really stupid thing to think, you know, like really arrogant. Oh, only Christians are nice. But it was a little bit of a, you know, because love can show up all over the place.
Yes.
And, you know, it was kind of like, it's a smack I should have gotten a long time ago, that to realize that in a deeper way, and that people can be kind in all different kinds of contexts, right, and very loving and generous.
You know, and something I found too is that I think that we program everything sometimes, or we have a real compulsion to program and organize and plan and facilitate that almost for people within, you know, a lot of church expressions. You know, you're a mom with young children, so obviously you want to hang out with other moms of young children. You know, well, a lot of times there's, you know, your likes and your dislikes and your personality and temperament. I mean, I've had, you know, I think that community is in those kinds of situations is good, because you would maybe hang out with people that you never would, or that you didn't know you had a lot in common with, or that you have nothing in common with, and yet for some reason you have the same sense of humor and you just hit it off and away you go. But I do feel like sometimes we have totally taken out the sense of the spirit, or that sense of magic that kind of happens when you just meet your kindred spirit. You know, when you kind of connect, maybe community is just kind of like that really churchy word for just being a really good friend. Right.
Yeah,
and sometimes, you know, when we try to program everything and organize everything and slice and dice and connect everybody based on demographic, you know, we miss the chance to have friends across generational lines, across genders, across all, you know, all kinds of different things. And that was something that I found a real gift to me, because some of my really deep friends actually weren't believers in Jesus. They weren't followers of Jesus. And yet we sharpened one another and learned so much from one another, and deeply loved one another and cared for one another. And so, yeah, it's, you know, I think that there is something there too, about how we kind of can tend to program too much and not give enough room for people just even being led by their passions and letting it have a little bit more time. Like, not, you know, if you can create community in two easy steps, then you're probably not really actually creating community.
Yeah, it probably doesn't work like that. Oh, well, one of the chapters in your book is called Obey the Sadness, and you talk about lament, and I really appreciated that. And maybe for people who are going to be getting a hold of your book, you can give them a taste of kind of what you're talking about there, and some of how you got to that point.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, that is probably my favorite chapter in the book, is that one. I know it's the one that probably a lot of people will skip over because they'll be really excited to read, you know, oh, what does she think about the Bible, you know?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And I get that. I understand that that's, you know, obviously, you know, very important to all of us. But that chapter for me has probably been one of the greatest shifts or changes in my life. You know, I started out in Barbara Brown Taylor has this amazing book called Learning to Walk in the Dark, and she kind of separates Christians into two types, solar and lunar. Mm-hmm. And I definitely grew up and came of age and loved the solar Christian kind of camp, right, where everything exists sort of in this, you know, light of certainty, right answers, bright day, cause and effect, mm-hmm. you know, those types of things. You know, we really liked, you know, answered prayers in the way that we thought they should be answered, you know, and, you know, really easy formulas to follow to kind of like make sure you got the outcome that you were looking for. And, you know, had a really narrow idea of what healing meant or of what wholeness maybe would look like, or, you know, all those kinds of things. And so for me, the phrase obeying the sadness is actually is something that Frederick Buechner has kind of introduced to me, but I think he got it from King Lear from, you know, the last act of one of Shakespeare's plays. But it's basically saying that we live in sad times, and it is a false thing to not obey that sadness. And for me, it was, I think that maybe that's something that until you have unanswered prayers, until you have walked a road of suffering and grief, until you have opened your eyes even to the world as it kind of goes along outside of maybe even your, you know, typical or you know, your personal experience that we experience in our own lives. There, I didn't know when I was confronted with those things how to be sad. I didn't know how to say that it wasn't right, and that I was longing for wholeness, and that I was really longing for resolution and redemption, and what it means to learn how to make peace with that and to sit in that tension well, and love people well in that moment. So for me, that is something that I think is deeply important. It's a conversation maybe we don't have enough. We're so quick to rush people through to healing, or we give out gold stars for people when we think that they get over things quickly. And so for being able to learn how to obey the sadness, to recognize it, and to hold grief and hope together at the same time, because I really don't think you can have hope without acknowledging that you have something that you need to be hoping for. Then, yeah, I think that that's it was deeply transformative for me over the last 10 or 15 years of my life. And it's something that I continue to wrestle with and to learn, is how to have hope and how to have faith and how to, you know, walk that out while at the same time holding space for suffering and for grief and for lament and for unfinished business. And, you know, as we are looking to sort of establish the kingdom of God here.
And, you know, what you're saying, it just is, it's just a beautiful thing. I've also kind of come into a deeper and richer understanding in my own life, having some pretty serious things to grieve about, and having a disabled son. You realize that, you know, you've lost some dreams of having a child that could take care of themselves. But I was really struck by the lamenting Psalms of David, but they are meant to be sung together, and it's the community that laments,
yeah,
that really you find healing. You could might be able to pray some of those lamenting Psalms to God on your own, but to feel that embrace of community, mm-hmm. and just say, you know, it does suck. What just happened, yeah, or what's going on now really does suck, and we are crying with you, and mm-hmm. and you don't have to just, you know, keep calm and carry on. Like, you don't have to just do the stiff upper lip and just kind of get on with your life. It's just, yeah, sad right now.
It is, you know, and I think that acknowledging that and having room for that, you know, and having support and being held, mm-hmm. in those moments is really sacred work. Mm. I think that we, you know, we maybe don't celebrate the ones who are really good listeners enough. Mm. And that's really key, you know, in those moments, especially when there's not a quick resolution,
right
for your, yeah, for your suffering or for the thing that you are grappling with. It will grapple with your whole life long.
Right.
You know, there's got to be room for joy and for change and for a new life ahead that maybe you hadn't anticipated. But that doesn't mean you're not also grieving the life you thought was coming. Mm.
Yeah. And it's hard to deal with other people's pain without feeling incredibly uncomfortable like,
oh, it's vulnerable.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. And it,
oh, true.
You kind of almost need people who are ready for it, who've already suffered, because it can be very awkward when people are very uncomfortable with your pain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the thing about people who find each other. I was just speaking to a woman who was doing a series of blog posts in a grieving process and wondering, maybe it's too much, or maybe I shouldn't be airing this. And I said, you know what, you're leading by example that we're allowed to have our feelings.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that's an important part of the process as we develop these communities, whether it's with Christians or our neighbors, our actual neighbors, that we allow enough space for some of the sadness to just live right alongside.
Yes. No, that's very true. And I think that you can really, those are really winnowing times in your life. I've noticed, you know, for me anyway, that, you know, the people that I thought were going to be, you know, right there with me during times of, you know, when I was grieving, mm-hmm. or experiencing loss or suffering, which, I mean, you know, pretty much anytime you feel a little bit out of control, mm-hmm. it feels like that. Mm-hmm. You know, the ones I thought maybe would be better or would be my people in that space oftentimes didn't know how, mm-hmm. right? They didn't have a language for it. They didn't have an answer for it. It didn't exist in their carefully kind of curated version of what God is and allows. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you're good, then good things happen, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, you know, that kind of separates you. You know, it is something that does set you apart. When you grieve really deeply or you suffer deeply. But then on the other side, you find the people who have walked that path have such a deep reserve of patience. Mm. And they understand that patience and faith need to work together, that you don't get to have really one without the other. And they understand, you know, what it means to be sad and what it means to be hopeful, and they can hold space in those places. And those are really rare and good friends. I think if any of us have even just one person like that in our life, we are incredibly fortunate.
How true. Yeah. There's one story that you, write about in your book that has to do with Ash Wednesday. And I thought that was a really neat, and also just your experience of being exposed to the liturgy for the first time. And I think not everybody listening is going to have been exposed to liturgy or maybe even be suspicious of it, or who knows, but maybe you can talk a little bit about that experience and that Ash Wednesday experience, or just at least talk around it if you don't want to, not like you have to give spoilers or anything.
Well, you know, it's funny because I often kind of wonder why it was Ash Wednesday that really captured my heart at that time. And I think it's because, you know, as opposed to like, you know, something that a lot of other people enjoy about the church calendar, or, you know, more of those times of celebration like Advent and, you know, Easter and even ordinary time. I really enjoy ordinary time quite a bit. But for some reason, Ash Wednesday, which is, you know, the kickoff or the start kickoff. Hi, I'm... You can tell which church tradition I come from. It's the starting point of Lent, right? Mm-hmm. Which is kind of like that, the 40 days leading up to Easter, when we, you know, have a time of confession and penitence and recognition of who we are, of our deep need for Christ. And I had, it was during that season of my life when I was really deeply questioning, separating myself from Christianity, separating myself from the church, separating myself because I was grieving, because I felt like there was no room for that in the expressions that I kind of had grown up in or knew at the time. And I didn't know that there were places in the church that had actually made space for that. And so that's I think, as much part of it as well, is just realizing that, you know, the tent of Christianity is a lot bigger than simply our own experiences therein, right? So I happened, just honestly, I have zero idea why I did this, mm-hmm. other than that it's just, I liked the look of this little church and people were kind of going into it. And I was on my lunch break at the time where I was working, and I just kind of walked in, mm-hmm. and I sat down at the back. I don't think I'd ever sat, you know, in on a liturgical service before. It was an Ash Wednesday service. And I remember listening to them read the Psalms, you know, like Psalm 51, the Psalms of confession, of grief, of admitting our humanity and our limitations and our questions, and listening to them, you know, pray through these prayers and sing these songs and speak these words out loud together as a community. And I just felt like something locked into place. Mm-hmm. Of here is a place, and here is a time, and here is a practice that will let me acknowledge the shadows. Mm-hmm. And acknowledge that deep need I have to admit that things are not great.
Right.
That things are not great in the world. Things are not great for whole people groups. Things are not great for whole sections of humanity. And finally, we get a chance to actually say it out loud instead of just kind of, you know, getting busier for Jesus and putting up, you know, more, you know, it's fine, we're fine, everything's fine, aren't we all fine kind of thing. Mm. And I remember walking, just, I have zero idea why I went forward, you know, other than just, I really felt compelled. Mm. And I received the imposition of the ashes when the priest sort of draws, you know, the sign of the cross on your forehead with ashes. And he said, remember, you are dust, and to dust you will return. Mm. And it just, I could have sat on the floor and wept because I needed to remember that. I needed that time of waiting, if that makes sense, of what that gave to me and the space that it gave to me. And so, you know, that opened up the door for me to be really curious about the church calendar and about liturgy and about, you know, liturgical traditions and about the larger story of the church. That opened up for me things like the Book of Common Prayer, where at a time in my life when I had completely forgotten how to pray or could not pray in the sort of victory overcomer quote in Bible verses way that I had kind of been taught how to pray, and that didn't feel authentic to me anymore. It wasn't the cry of my heart anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know how to pray anymore. Mm. And being able to come alongside the church worldwide and pray the prayers that pilgrims and believers had been praying for centuries and will be praying today, and praying alongside of all those things, and almost getting that sense of continuity and that sense of togetherness and not feeling so alone, and giving me words to pray when I simply could not pray, retaught me how to pray, and then reopened that door, you know, ended up opening up all the ways that we pray, you know, whether that's, you know, with our hands or with our attention or praying in tongues, or it's praying even in the way now that I grew up learning how to pray. I've even recaptured that. And so being able to have all those things that, you know, but the Book of Common Prayer and those practices of, you know, praying the daily offices and the times and the set times of prayer and the seasons of the church and the rhythm of it, you know, just held me in a time when I felt unmoored.
Mm, yeah, it is. Did you get to see any of the papal visit to the U.S.?
No, not a whole lot, actually. I saw a wee bit here and there, but not too much.
Well, I can send you a link. There's a PBS station that has recorded a bunch of pretty much all of the messages that he gave were recorded, and then they're on this one page. But it was really interesting. But the one thing that really stood out to me is there was this big mass on Sunday in Philadelphia, and you know, nuns were having tailgate parties. This is like very celebratory, you know. And one of the most beautiful things was that communion was open to the public to the tune of about 250,000 people could participate.
Wow.
So you have 500 priests out, and they all have these attendants holding these yellow and white umbrellas over them. And they're going out into the crowds gathered in Philadelphia. And it was like one of the nuns said, it's like Philadelphia has turned into one big church. And it was just one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. I don't know of a bigger organized like event like that in public, in, you know, not in a stadium or something. This is just out there in the streets. But the liturgy of the Mass is very specific, and it has, you know, not being that familiar with it, it has very, very specific things you say, and it was done in Latin, in Spanish, in English and in Vietnamese, because the World Meeting of Families had a lot of representation from Vietnam. So just this worldwide multilingual expression and the gift of the Eucharist out there. And, it's on, I could get a Philadelphia station. So they were running it like 48 hours of papal visit. This was a big deal around here. So it was just unprecedented. And I really appreciated the message. But the liturgy was very striking to me, because I don't come from all that much of a liturgical background. But what was so interesting is the format, although I'm sure can be confining for people at some point, was for many others so reassuring. I know I can participate. I know what's going to happen next. And, it was just really amazing to see that. And I'm wondering, in terms of, like, do you have any experience with liturgy now in your regular life, or how do you interact with it, or if you do at this point?
That's one of those things that I find so funny, I guess is the best word, because it's funny to me, because I really did think in the season of my life when I was discovering these things, which is adorable. I mean, it's absolutely adorable that someone can manage to be a Christian for like 30 years of their life and yet never have been exposed to any of this stuff. And by adorable, I mean probably pretty tragic.
Oh, okay.
But, it's one of those things where I really did think that for the rest of my life, I would be in liturgical churches, because it was so rich and so deep for me. But I think I underestimated my roots and their strength. Mm. And I think it's one of those things now that I have kind of ended up, I suppose, as a bit of, kind of people jokingly or rather derisively call, cafeteria Christian, right? Where they kind of pull things from all these different, traditions and, kind of create their own feast, right? Mm-hmm. And that's more or less sort of where I've ended up, because every time I have tried to make a habit or to make, create a community or pursue sort of, church in more of a liturgical setting, I am so incredibly homesick for my roots.
Right.
That I still crave that low church, in the dirt church, chorus, flag waving, really charismatic expressions. Mm-hmm. I miss the noise, and I miss the mess of it. Mm-hmm. I love the spirit-ledness of it. I miss the unscripted scriptedness, almost, if that makes any right. sense. And so even though I continue to draw a lot of richness out of that tradition, and I like to worship with believers who sort of are in that stream, I have found that I went swimming in that stream and came home, and I continue to worship in a church that does not, observe the church calendar, and probably never will, to be honest. And that I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. That's something that now kind of enriches our family life, that we, use maybe sometimes in community groups or, with our smaller circle of friends, and that we really acknowledge, kind of more within our home, things like Advent and Holy Week and Lent and Ash Wednesday. And I still pray the offices, and I still turn to the Book of Common Prayer, even though those things were never meant to be individualistic. Those things were always meant to be communal. Mm-hmm. And so for me, even though maybe it's not communal in the sense of my every Sunday community, it's communal in the sense of my connection to the broader church, which is still really deeply important to me. I think that that's a shift that's happening perhaps in these days, or in this time, or this generation, or however you want to put it. That we really are moving beyond kind of that tribalism or that sense of, labels, small boxes, either you get this or you get that, but you don't get both. Mm-hmm. And I really kick against that. I deeply appreciate the ones who introduced me to Jesus, and I want them, but I also really want you know, the ones who helped me hang on to Jesus, and the ones who are helping me to hang on now and are setting, you know, bringing richness into my life. So whether it was coming from a Southern Baptist tradition and the things that I learned from my friends who were in that, you know, tradition, or people who come from more of a Reform background than myself, and the things that the richness and understanding that they brought to my life, even in our disagreements. You know, Mennonites, I, you know, have found a lot of connection with Anabaptists and Mennonites in this season of my life. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you've got, you know, a really strong Anglican tradition that has really enriched me. And but at the same time, I am still a low church, happy clappy mm-hmm. kid. And I think I probably always will be. And I've just made my peace with that and, have, you know, tried to, you know, balance that meal out with so that it's more of a well-balanced meal as opposed to just, you know, making a meal at the ice cream bar.
Right. Yeah. So. You know, well, what you're saying is really, really important. And it's not like you're settling. Like that's the thing that, you know, that can come like a self-condemnation, like, well, I guess I'm settling for what I grew up with. But let's face it, that formed you the most, you know, yeah. So it makes sense. And people, I've heard it too. Well, since I went to seminary, I was exposed to a whole bunch of different things and loved that and pulled from each tradition and in many ways. And people can sort of deride that as, oh, it's consumerist or it's cafeteria, like you're saying. But doesn't God have a banquet table? You know, it's yeah. It is a banquet table. It's not like, okay, sushi today and forever. You know, there's a lot there.
It is. And I feel like we have so much to learn from one another. And I, you know, I know a lot of people can kind of get really discouraged almost by the, you know, sheer amount of even, you know, Protestant denominations that we have. There's mm-hmm. like 44,000 or something last time I remember reading research, I think, when I was, you know, writing the book. Mm-hmm. But if anything, I almost kind of like it, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense. Like, we're still the church. Mm-hmm. We're still all the bride of Christ. We are still all here. But yet there are so many different expressions, and I love the diversity of that. I love the, you know, that there's a place for all of us, a place where we belong. I think the problem is when we get insulated into those streams, when we aren't talking to one another and joining hands across those, you know, kind of self-imposed boundaries of mm-hmm. of things and you know, receiving from one another. So, I mean, I feel like if your hands are open, mm-hmm. that's a real rich thing for us, that there are all these different ways of encountering God and experiencing God and knowing God. And I always feel like I love Jesus better when I hear why and how other people love him. Mm-hmm. And so that is, you know, a real gift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things you mentioned in the book that I it took me by surprise, and I think a lot of people will appreciate your take on this. You talk about the wrath of God, and you know, in the beginning, yeah, that sounds, how about that for a transition?
Like, let me run out and buy that book.
Hang on, yeah, you know, in the beginning of the book, of course, you're talking about some of the like really unsavory parts of the Bible and not knowing what to do with them. And you start off with some of the things in the Bible and the Bible worship that sometimes is prevalent. And, you know, thinking more about context and a group of people and who God was to them and things like that. But then you also touch on this wrath of God thing, and not to, you know, you won't spoil it for anyone to give a little bit of broad strokes of that, because I appreciated how you brought that out.
Yeah, the wrath of God thing is something that I still feel like I almost see it out of the corner of my eye, and I feel like I see it, but I'm still kind of locking it into to full look perhaps. Mm. But for me, it was really connected to what I believed about the sovereignty of God, mm-hmm. And what I thought that meant. And so for me, it means sovereignty, for instance, you know, and how I kind of reconcile the wrath of God and how all those things sort of, you know, come together, is that I see, and have, you know, studied and learned and discovered a lot of different, you know, opinions on that. But the way that I've sort of settled or landed on it right now is that for me, sovereignty is not God ordained your baby to die, or God, you know, ordained these people to go to hell and these people to go to heaven and, you know, good luck. Mm. Or, you know, things like hurricanes or, you know, systemic injustice or whatever. I feel like sovereignty to me is a promise that all those things will be redeemed, mm-hmm. that we are all heading towards redemption, mm-hmm. that sovereignty means that God is at work, mm-hmm. that we can trust that, but that all good gifts come from God, that there is no shadow in him. And that for me, wrath is actually something to welcome because it is the full force of God's furious love against the things that are reducing the image of God in us, mm-hmm. or negating it or tearing it apart. Mm-hmm. So for instance, if you had, you know, cancer, the wrath of God would be what is focused on that cancer, that thing that is killing you, that thing that is, you know, going to take your life. It's not against you. Mm-hmm. You are deeply beloved. You are made in the image of mm-hmm. God. And so for me, wrath feels more like a rescue. Mm-hmm. And maybe we have misunderstood it and thought that the wrath was against us, when in reality, we were made in the image of God. We carry the breath of God. We are deeply beloved by God, and that love will win. Mm. So for me, the wrath and the sovereignty is actually not a scary thing anymore. And it's not this terrifying vision of some judgmental, you know, God who's just out to, you know, pick us off, mm-hmm. you know, like that spider hanging over hell sort of imagery that we've kind of have heard from a lot of revivalists over, you know, the 18th century and whatnot. You know, I think that it's a deeply complex thing, mm-hmm. and yet at the same time, very simple. I feel like so much of the, I'm sorry, I know I'm getting probably a little bit all over the place, but a lot of it has to do with what we believe about Jesus, mm-hmm. and how almost all of our theology, almost all of the things, we are almost always tipping our hand about what we really believe about the nature and the character of who God is. Mm-hmm. And of course, for me, I have learned to read, this, you know, the Bible. I have learned to understand God. I am still learning all these things through the lens of Jesus, because Jesus, you know, showed us all the ways that we had mischaracterized and misrepresented and misunderstood who God is. We thought that God was this, but Jesus came to show us, no, God is this. God is love. God is sacrifice. God is, you know, the crucified Lamb of God. Right. And resurrection and redemption and all the, you know, all those things that are just so incredibly beautiful and whole and filled with peace and goodness. And so for me, though, like, how do you possibly separate, you know, those conversations about, you know, theological concepts like sovereignty and wrath and whatever else from who the person of Jesus is and everything that he showed us about the Spirit and about God the Father and about how their relationship works, and then how we are sort of a part of that relation and community. Yeah, it's a really beautiful thing. And so for me, understanding sovereignty and wrath in that context or in that light, what does it say about what I believe about who God is, mm-hmm. is probably a bigger question.
Yeah, what you're saying also reminds me about God as a purifying fire.
Yes.
And that, you know, that fire isn't to harm us, although it could be painful, but the fire is to burn off what is not of God. And Jesus talks about that, you know, if your hand offends you, you know, using metaphor, but also God, because God is for us, he will, in the end, redeem everything to good, which means some of the stuff's got to burn away.
Right.
And that is the justice of God, means that things are put to rights. And so that means some stuff has to go, and that, yeah. that's going to be painful for some people. That's going to be uncomfortable for some people. And ultimately, good wins and God wins. And I think that that's an important part of understanding God's love for us, is that that is all done for our benefit, you know, mm-hmm. not as a punishment to us. That is done absolutely. Because he loves us, you know. And I think that that can get twisted around in the behavior modification stuff, the sin management, as you talk about it. It can be like, watch out, you know, yeah. Watch out, he might get you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That is a great way of looking at it, you know, and it is purifying. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, what I have learned about that process as I have walked through that fire and I've walked through that purification and continue to do that, mm-hmm. is that then all of a sudden you begin to welcome it. Mm. because by that point it becomes like in Hebrews 12, where Paul or whoever wrote Hebrews talks about. Well, we will open up that can of worms. Just drop that in there. You know, when the writer of Hebrews says, you know, that we want to run the race that is set before us, and casting off every sin and everything that so easily besets us, and that's kind of what I envision almost when it comes to that wrath of God, of just, it is the flinging off of those things that are holding you back, because they are chains and they are holding you back, right? That it becomes a relief. In one of C.S. Lewis's novels, I think it's The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, he writes about that boy Eustace, yes, who becomes the dragon.
Love that.
And that scene at the end of the book, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't read the book, it's part of the Narnia Chronicles. Eustace is, you know, a really rotten kid, and he becomes the dragon. And then at the end of the story, or near the end of the story, Aslan sets him free from the dragon skin, but it is painful, and the only thing that that offsets the pain of it is the relief from being free of it. Yeah. And that's sometimes how I think about that process for me, is like, you know what, it is painful sometimes to have my hypocrisy, or to have my know-it-all-ness, or my aggression, or my all the things that are, whether they're sin or they're bad habits or they're whatever else, having those things uprooted can sometimes be a very deeply painful thing. Mm-hmm. But it is always offset by the relief of being free from it, and then being healed, and then being able to move forward as who you really are, you know, in Eustace's case, as a boy instead of as a dragon. Mm-hmm. You know, and for me, that is a picture I've never been able to get out of my head when I think about what that means to, you know, kind of have that focused attention of the Holy Spirit on an area of my life where it's like, you know what, now it's time to take care of this.
Mm. Yeah. I don't know if you've read the book. I believe it's John Stackhouse wrote Can God Be Trusted? And mm-hmm. points to...
It's a great book.
Yeah,
a great
book. Theology of Suffering. And yeah, and he really comes down to understanding suffering in terms of, can we trust God that he has our best interests in mind? And a lot of times, for myself, it showed a mirror to my soul that when I've had a problem with what I think God has made a mistake on, or, you know, what just happened there, or I'm angry at you about something, I am also superimposing false images of God, human images, I would say, then onto God, and thinking, I can't trust you because I couldn't trust other people or whatever it is. Yeah. And not thinking of God as, well, he is either going to be a benevolent, good God, or things would be really, really, really different than they are right now. And and so it does kind of come down to this kernel of, if we know that suffering, while unpleasant, and I wouldn't say God is like, now what cruel thing can I do to this person today? And if we don't think of God that way, we need to embrace that we can trust God, and that he's trustable, and that sometimes incredibly perplexing, but that ultimately it does boil down to this relational thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know, if was there ever a time in your journey that you felt God couldn't be trusted, or did it kind of work out a different way for you?
You know, that book was actually really helpful for me. That specific book. John Stackhouse is a great theologian, great teacher. He was actually one of my husband's professors when my husband was in seminary. And he's a really good, really good teacher and theologian. And for me, yeah, I mean, I feel like that was a really helpful thing for me as I was, you know, sort of wrestling through all of that. And I did land, you know, because I think that it does come down to the question of, you know, can God be trusted? Is this where I want to throw my lot in, or am I, you know, kind of tap dancing in an effort to earn approval? You know, and how petty is my view of God even? And so, yeah, no, those are really deep questions that I feel like oftentimes you cannot even answer, you know, with really neatly cataloged, you know, 3-ring binders of, you know, highlighted, you know, and here's the answer in 6 lines or less. Sometimes it's more like of a deep knowing that you almost have sort of in your gut of how you experience and understand God, and how you've sort of reconciled even your own experiences in life, and even how you reconcile some of those larger questions, you know, for humanity as well.
So the main gist of your book does seem to be about being okay with the messiness and the growing pains that are inevitable, and an invitation really to kind of appreciate the differences among us and be okay with questions and doubts. But if there was one, if you could put it in the one message you hope people get from your book, what would that be?
You know, at the beginning of the book, you know, and actually in the dedication of the book, I dedicated it to my four children, with the idea in my head that at some point they will no doubt wrestle with the faith that I am handing them mm-hmm. and that I am sort of giving them. And I was thinking, you know, when I was walking through that season of reconciling and wrestling, what do I wish most of all that someone had said to me? And to me, I feel like this book is, you know, not so much about each of the topics with which I'm wrestling. My heart and my intent is never to say, everybody now needs to agree with me, you know,
right.
or even that I'm right all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I hope I'm right. That certainly is where I've landed. But, you know, it's more for me about permission and about, I think if I could say anything to anyone who is feeling a bit out of sorts or feeling like they are kind of caught between who they once were and they're not yet sure where they're headed or where they will end up. And they're kind of in that liminal space, which is awkward and scary and disorienting. But then I think the thing that I have most wanted to say to people as they are embarking on that, or as they are in the midst of it, or as they are circling back around on it, is don't be afraid.
Yeah.
You don't need to be afraid, and that you are so incredibly loved.
Mm-hmm.
You are so deeply loved, and there is safety in that. Even if there is not safety for your opinions, and there is not safety for your way that you kind of thought you would move through life, but there is a rest I think a peace that comes from knowing that you are held. Even in these moments, you know, I'd often return to Psalm 139 where, you know, David writes about how, you know, how far could I go from your spirit? Even if I went down to the depths, there you would find me.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like when I went to the depths, or I went to what I thought was the furthest reach, you know, and yet I found God there. I found the people of God there. I found release and relief there. And so for me, I feel like the message of the book and the thing that I would most want to say to anybody, if they were, you know, sitting across from me, whether it was my own child or, you know, my mother or anybody at any point and stage in their life, is that you don't have to be afraid, and that you are really very deeply loved, and you can trust that. And so you can you don't have to be afraid to press into this season and to walk into it.
Yeah. God is at work in that as well. And yeah, that's the Ignatian spirituality that I enjoyed so much recently, that God is always at work in whatever stage, in whatever
absolutely
place you find yourself, and that you just trust the process.
Yes. You know, and you can sort of walk out in that with this sense of God is so much more generous and loving and wild and wonderful and good than I think we will ever be able to understand or comprehend. And oftentimes you don't really discover that until you're a little bit out in the wilderness.
Amen. This felt like I went to church. Oh, you are such a delight. I love speaking with you. So, well, many blessings as you launch this book out into the wild, and I know it'll find fertile ground, because there are a lot of people who need that balm of solace to know that God does love them, that their time of confusion is normal and it's okay. You know, it's gonna be okay. And so I appreciate that you're bringing that message out, and hopefully we'll touch base in the future and as you embark on your next projects and things like that. But I'm just so tickled that you came back on.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me, Lisa. I enjoy our conversations every time we chat, and just so appreciate your time.
Thank you, Sarah. So enjoy your day, and I will be back in touch. I don't know if you'll be able to do a live. What I changed since the last time we talked is that I try to invite guests, if they're able, to come on the day or the day after the podcast airs to talk to listeners about in live real time about any questions they had about the podcast or the book or project that they're working on. And if that works out for your schedule, it would be or we could change the time and things like that. It tends to be on Tuesdays, which would be, I believe, 5 p.m. for you on your time. But that would be really fun. So we'll have to see if we can coordinate that, if it would work out.
Yeah. If that would work out, I would love it. Yeah. Yeah, that would be a lot of fun.
All right. Well, enjoy your day, and I will contact you again soon.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Lisa. Thank appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Did you know that every episode of Spark My Muse has show notes? You can find show notes at sparkmymuse.com, and in those show notes you'll find details about the people, books, and resources that were mentioned in the show. And sometimes you'll find photos and embedded videos too. I hope you'll stop by and check it out.